Hey everyone, welcome back to the Book Spider Podcast, a book of the week style program that features three dudes being as elitist as possible about novels, plays, poetry, and even music sometimes. One of those dudes, myself, Patrick Barney, is genuinely an elite with several billion dollars in his bank account. The other two, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger, rely on wit and insight to maintain their sense of superiority. Today, we're going to chat up a collection of poems by Charles Baudelaire called The Flowers of Evil. Besides praying to Satan and using corpses as the basis of love poems to his mistress, Baudelaire delves deep into rhyming forms, including iambic pentameter and the villanelle. He obsesses with the ideal, all while dreaming of witches, vampires, succubi, and other erotic monsters. He also seems to like drugs a fair bit. Anything from alcohol to opium floats his boat. Overall, The Flowers of Evil is a hymn to the obscene, its purpose perhaps to rebel against a hypocritic Christian morality at the center of Parisian culture.
I just want to throw in a quick correction there. I actually rely on wit and incest to maintain my sense of superiority.
Oh, okay. How does incest give you a sense of superiority?
Look, man, if you've never given a hand job to your cousin, you wouldn't understand.
Fair enough. The way I've arranged my questions for this one is to address some specific works, which I thought, like, I'll read the question, then I'll read the work, the poem and that is in the question. And then we can chat about it. So we can talk about some specific poems that mostly I kind of picked at random, except for maybe For a Creole Lady, which is probably, I think, the most famous poem from this collection. And then after we talk about the specific poems, maybe we can like draw some larger themes or ideas out of it. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was the narrator's obsession with death and decay. So let's take a look at the Happy Corpse, poem 72, to see if, like, we can learn anything about this obsession. So the poem goes: in a rich land, fertile, replete with snails, I'd like to dig myself a spacious pit where I might spread at leisure my old bones and sleep unnoticed, like a shark at sea. I hate both testaments and epitaphs. Sooner than beg remembrance from the world, I would, alive, invite the hungry crows to bleed my tainted carcass inch by inch. Oh, worms, dark playmates minus ear or eye, perhaps to meet a free and happy corpse, droll philosophies, children of rottenness. Go then along my ruin guiltlessly, and say if any torture still exists for this old soulless corpse, dead with the dead. So, yeah. Why do we have a poem about a happy corpse? What is this? I mean, other than the striking imagery, the being in a pit replete with snails and whatnot. What do we think the narrator's doing here?
Well, in this instance at least, I mean, it seems like an image of comfort, right? It seems like an image of rest and comfort. I mean, in the collection as a whole, there are so many images of, you know, despair and frustration and desperation and the world just generally seems like an intolerable burden, right? And so in this particular instance, there's a sense of attraction to death as a form of rest, right? Attraction to death as the end of all the kind of a respite from all the kind of grossness of the world. And I mean, you know, from I'm not a huge expert on Baudelaire's actual life or biography, right? But I mean, the introduction to this edition talks somewhat about, you know, he was constantly in debt and kind of had a number of I guess, you know, the struggles that many many people of his time and place would have. And so there's an appeal in the there's an appeal in the idea of giving up, essentially, right? I mean, I think last time we did the podcast, we were talking about in Robert Aikman's fiction, the subtle I'm not sure what the word is for it exactly, the subtle seduction of giving up, right? And that there's kind of the same idea here, but in you know, life itself rather than just the artistic struggle.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't know that I see in this poem in isolation a lot of the why. I think it's in the greater context of the collection. We're going to talk about the spleen poems, I believe. And I had thought I had remembered this, and I did look it up. And, you know, spleen is the you know, where, you know, bile, the humor bile was thought to be produced, which, you know, contributed to melancholia and basically ennui and depression. And it does seem as though there is a kind of I mean, it's the poem is sort of like overt, right? It's the happy corpse, like basically like inverting the our sort of traditional ideas of what we should be happy about. And, you know, this is just kind of starting from that point of kind of a simple sort of like, well, let's just imagine that being a corpse is a great pleasure, because what we thought we, you know, what we popular try, what we popular celebrate life, popularly celebrate is life, and life is actually kind of shit. So, I don't necessarily, I think it's like, it kind of hints at those things, with, you know, rest, sleep, playmates that are not humans, you know, and not having to associate with humans is actually, desirable. And then for someone who's a creator, who's an author, it is interesting maybe to hear him say that, like, he doesn't really want testaments or epitaphs. Want to be remembered.
That's humorous.
Yeah.
Since, you know, I hate both testaments and epitaphs. Sooner than beg remembrance from the world, I would alive invite the hungry crows to bleed my tainted carcass inch by inch, which, you know, is a strong, very strong image of being skinned alive by crows, which you can't really believe them, can you? I mean,
of course you can't believe
given
him.
That.
Yeah.
What?
Of course you can't believe him. He published a book. All no, artists are obsessed with testaments and epitaphs. It's by the very nature of, you know, it's sorry, go ahead.
I suppose, like, I obviously agree that the narrator of these poems is probably the persona is very similar to who Baudelaire probably actually was in his own mind, right? But just for the sake of the discussion, I was thinking we can't believe the narrator as opposed to Baudelaire. And, like, we can't believe the narrator because he says, I hate both testaments and epitaphs, but this is a written piece, right? Which is both a testament and an epitaph of sorts.
Well, and
obviously you're...
Sorry, go ahead. Obviously my...
I was just going to say, obviously you're right. Like, of course we can't believe Baudelaire. He wrote a bunch of poems, you know.
Well, and this kind of, that line about hating testaments and epitaphs and the kind of transparent hypocrisy of it, that made me, you know, one of the things that I wondered a lot as I was reading this collection, and maybe there is no right answer to this, right? Maybe this is totally within the realm of personal response and interpretation, but like, how much of this is ironic? Because there's so much melodrama here, right? Like, so many, everything is presented in this kind of intense, over the top, emotional way,
right.
And there are a lot of places where there were a lot of places for me as a reader where, and you know, this just has to do with personal reactions again, but there are places where that kind of just this almost kind of teenage or adolescent or childish intensity of feeling and lack of self awareness made it very hard for me to connect with the work, right? Or would take me out of a poem that I had kind of been enjoying. And, but I mean, if you read that as self-mockery, right? If you read that as kind of a parody or a satire of the pretensions of the artist, or a parody or a satire of the pretensions of a certain kind of individual, or just kind of, you know, self-loathing, self-mockery, right? Then that becomes much more tolerable and even amusing in its way, right?
Well, I don't know whether, you know, Baudelaire is writing these like ironically or whether he is writing them sincerely, but I do know that I enjoy them ironically, but probably not sincerely, right? Like reading this ironically, I like it. Like I find it like the melodrama I find amusing. And I do like to think of the melodrama as a very, hey, I'm poking fun at myself. I'm poking fun at, you know, this romantic ecstasy that I find myself in, or that anyone else finds themselves in, much the same way I would enjoy like a typo negative lyric, right? Like, you know, where everyone I love is dead or something.
Yeah, and I guess typo negative is a good comparison because, I mean, with typo negative, there's this real legitimate sadness and true self-loathing that is kind of being run through a couple layers of irony because that's the only way that it can really be expressed, right? I mean, that's partly from self-consciousness, I would imagine, and partly from machismo, like the only way to kind of lay those emotions out is to turn them into a joke, but they only have power because of the understanding of the reality below the joke. And if you, thinking of this collection that way, I feel a lot more fondness for it than, reading it like one would a lot of romantic poetry where there's just this real fundamental lack of self-critique, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely approach this as I would a typo negative, the lyrics of a typo negative record. That's how I approach it and how I enjoy it.
Which is very fitting, I suppose, because like it is something that, you know, this is one of those works that you encounter every now and again where it unlocks a certain number of things that you already knew that you didn't understand were references, right? Or mean, in particular, I don't know if you've ever listened to Dead Can Dance, but their second album is called Spleen and Ideal. And there are, they don't really have lyrics for the most part on that album, but there are a lot of like the song titles and stuff. There are these references to poems from Flowers of Evil. And so, And I don't know if I have any other great examples off the top of my head, but I mean, you can get the sense reading this of how influential this was on a lot of much later stuff like you know, goth music, that kind of thing. I don't know that I'd appreciated that until now. So,
so you brought this up, Chris, the Happy Corpse. You didn't necessarily see the why, but then you connected it to the spleen poems, and I was gonna talk about those anyway. So let's scroll down through our document to the first spleen, which is number 75, and I will just read all four of the spleen poems, which will take a few minutes, but I don't know whether they're separate poems or like they're titled like they're separate poems, but they're obviously related. So I'll just read them. Spleen one. Pluvius, this whole city on his nerves, spills from his great urn great waves of chilling rain on graveyard's pallid inmates, and he pours mortality in gloomy district streets. My restless cat goes scratching on the tiles to make a litter for his scabby hide. Some poet's phantom roams the gutter spouts, moaning and whimpering like a freezing soul. A great bell wails within the smoking log, pipes in falsetto to a wheezing clock. And meanwhile, in a reeking deck of cards, some dropsied crone's foreboding legacy, the dandy jack of hearts and queen of spades, trade sinister accounts of wasted love. I do enjoy that line, dropsied crone. Well, that image. Spleen two. More memories than if I'd lived 1,000 years. A giant chest of drawers stuffed to the full with balance sheets, love letters, lawsuits, verse romances, locks of hair rolled in receipts, hides fewer secrets than my sullen skull. It is a pyramid, a giant vault, holding more corpses than a common grave. I am a graveyard hated by the moon, where like remorse the long worms crawl and turn attention to the dearest of my dead. I am a dusty boudoir where are heaped yesterday's fashions, and where withered roses, pale pastels, and faded old bouchers alone breathe perfume from an opened flask. Nothing is longer than the limping days when under heavy snowflakes of the years, ennui, the fruit of dulling lassitude, takes on the size of immortality. Henceforth, O living flesh, you are no more, you are of granite, wrapped in a vague dread, slumbering in some Sahara's hazy sands, an ancient sphinx lost to a careless world, forgotten on the map, whose haughty mood sings only in the glow of setting sun. Spleen 3. I might as well be king of rainy lands, wealthy and young, but impotent and old, who scorns the troop of tutors at his feet and dallies with his dogs and other beasts. Nothing can cheer him, game or falconry, not even subjects dying at his door. The comic jingles of the court buffoon do not amuse this twisted invalid. His regal bed is nothing but a tomb, and courtesans who dote on any prince no longer have the antics or the clothes to get a smile from this young rack of bones. The alchemist who made him gold cannot attend his soul and extirpate the flaw, nor in those baths of blood the Romans claimed would bring an old man's body youthful force. Can scholars' knowledge bring to life a corpse with Lethe's putrid water in his veins? Spleen 4. When low and heavy sky weighs like a lid upon the spirit moaning in ennui, and when spanning the circle of the world it pours a black day sadder than our nights, when earth is chained into a sweaty cell in which hope, captured like a frantic bat, batters the walls with her enfeebled wing, striking her head against the rotting beams, when steady rain trailing its giant train descends on us like heavy prison bars, and when a silent multitude of spiders spins its disgusting threads deep in our brains, bells all at once jump out with all their force and hurl about a mad cacophony, as if they were those lost and homeless souls who sent a dogged whining to the skies. And long cortages minus drum are toned, deeply morose, deploy morosely through my being. Hope, the conquered, moans and tyrant anguish gloats. In my bowed skull, he fixes his black flag. So, you know, a lot of, like, a lot of pessimistic, dark imagery, chilling rain, graveyards, gloomy district streets, the dropsied crone that I mentioned.
The scabby cat, yeah.
The scabby cat, which is awesome. And then in that's spleen one. Then in spleen two, we have memories. He starts it off, more memories than if I'd lived 1,000 years. So we can assume that he's recalling, the narrator is recalling things, a giant chest of drawers filled with different things. There's a giant vault that holds a bunch of corpses.
Yeah, an accumulation of, that is valueless. I mean, it's, and
yeah.
What is the line that gets me here is, ennui takes on the size of mortality, like immortality. Like if you are trapped, if basically being trapped in like infinite, like, meaninglessness.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
These are interesting poems, I think, because like this is a really kind of one-dimensional reductive thing to say. Right. But I think like an idea that you might encounter sometimes about poetry is that like part of what poetry is meant to do is elevate the mundane, right? Elevate the quotidian, right? You read a poem about, you know, doing your laundry, and it elevates the quotidian task of doing the laundry into something which contains aesthetic grandeur and a kind of spiritual transcendence, right? Like that's,
and the Flowers of Evil even does that with like he has several poems about cats,
right. But what's happening with these spleen poems is an inverse of that, where he's using poetry to kind of, he's using poetry to put this filter of just kind of melodramatic awfulness over all these kinds of day-to-day things, right? And over just it's like you know, shit-colored glasses, basically. Like his poetic style is shit-colored glasses, like
the, you know,
like the whole idea of like a lifetime of memories, right? Like taking the idea of a lifetime of experience and metaphorically turning that into a giant vault full of corpses, for instance, right? Or, you know, the old ladies playing cards, right? Like calling them dropsied crones. Like it's at some point, individual instances of it are surprising or interesting, but then like the weight of accumulation of all the times that he does that kind of thing really kind of initially is kind of depressing is maybe too simple a word for it, right? But like it at first it's clever and surprising, and then after about the fifth time it becomes a little bit gross.
Numbing.
And then after like the 15th time, it comes all the way back around into comical, and it begins to almost kind of have a perversely joyful effect, right? Because I mean, I think like any kind of, it's like why, you know, Slayer becomes happy music, right? Because like the sort of, if you take any artistic practice and you do it to its absolute extreme, that becomes kind of a celebratory act ultimately, regardless of the content of it, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I like that comparison to like Slayer or really any kind of extreme band, like, you know, like my brother and I just went to see Immolation again here in Cincinnati. That's like the third or fourth time I've seen them. And, you know, they beat your brain out on stage for like 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how many bands are with them. Like they just beat the shit out of your brain. And like taken by itself, like it might be like you'd think it's too loud or it's too harsh or something like that, but the cumulative effect is just catharsis, right?
Although with Immolation, there are, I mean, it's been a while since I listened to Immolation, but the thing about Immolation is if you pay attention to what they're doing, I've never seen them live, but if you like listen to one of their albums and like listen to it enough to kind of penetrate that initial veil of bludgeoning monotony, there are actually a lot of really interesting and creative and surprising things happening below the surface, mm-hmm. right? And you Absolutely. have to learn to listen through the monotony to understand the compositional variety. Do you think there's an mm-hmm. equivalent to that here?
Well, that actually kind of brings me to another one of my questions, and I don't know if there's a similar compositional variety, but like take poem number 61 for a Creole Lady, which is as I mentioned in the intro, Baudelaire does pay a lot of attention to form. Like all his poems are forms. You know, granted, free verse didn't come along until the 20th century, so he's writing 120, 130 years before free verse is really even an idea. So obviously he's going to be writing in forms, but like he's very meticulous. He doesn't tend to really break form too much. So like For a Creole Lady is a nice variation on a love sonnet. I think it's a closest to a Petrarchan form. And but there's really not any images with evil, disease, death. So let me read it out loud. Unless you get, I'll do it. You guys don't have to. And we'll talk about whether this maybe is an example of compositional variety that we're talking about. So 61 for a Creole Lady. Off in a perfumed land bathed gently by the sun, under a palm tree's shade tinged with a crimson trace, a place where indolence drops on the eyes like rain, I met a Creole lady of unstudied grace. This brown enchantress skin is warm and light in tone, her neck is noble, proud, her manner dignified. Slender and tall, she goes with a huntress's easy stride. Her smile is tranquil and her eyes are confident. Madame, if you should come to place of pride and praise, beside the green Loire or the pleasant sign, adorning ancient mansions with your stately ways, there in the shelter of the shady groves, you'd start 1,000 sonnets blooming in the poet's hearts, whom your great eyes would turn to sycophants and slaves. So only in that final line do we have anything that really kind of feels like some of this other stuff. We were like sycophants and slaves is fairly dark, but otherwise it's, you know, it's just a dude ogling a woman like the way they've always done in poetry for hundreds of years before this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I is there... Are you going to suggest that there is a dark underbelly to this poem, Patrick? Or
I don't I mean, not exactly. Like, as far as I know, this is a poem about the woman who became Baudelaire's mistress, and they had an on-again, off-again relationship for a long, long time. And, like, they were together for a while, and then they'd break up, then they'd get back together. And ultimately, like, I think they broke up, but he still, like, paid for her living situation in Paris, and, like, made sure she had food or whatever. I'm not sure of all the details. So I wouldn't say that this is, like, that's kind of normal, right? Like, people have on again, off again romantic relationships all the time. And, like, this would be a love poem that, you would write at the beginning of a relationship, right?
Yeah, if you're a poet and you're not using your words to try and woo a lady, then I don't know what the fuck you're doing. So,
right, yeah. You're clearly, like, what else have you got?
Nowadays, probably, I might advise my son, like, hey, poetry might not work. It's the 21st century. You should probably, like, get on Instagram. But, like,
you guys
1860s.
Know
yeah, he's going to be a boy.
You're gonna be a boy, huh? Yeah. Congrats, man.
And I'm gonna give him the realistic, sort of truth. Like, poetry is sort of definitely like probably effective in the 19th century, maybe less effective today. Yeah. But I do have a question about like as far as like assembling a work, right? So like you pulled this poem out because it feels like it strikes a different chord.
Right.
And Hans talked about how the successive like darkness kind of propels the work as a whole on an arc where at first the kind of darkness is effective in a sort of explicit, maybe even depressing way, and then in an explicit compelling way, then it becomes kind of depressing, and then it kind of circles back around and kind of becomes a little bit funny because of just how it keeps on hitting those notes.
Right.
And as far as like, assembling a work, is for a Creole lady something that belongs in this work? And if so, why does it belong in this work? And I'm not a poet, and it might be very unfair of me to ask that question. But I'm not sure what the value of thematic consistency versus difference and variation over a collection of poetry specifically, amounts to. I could think about it maybe with a collection of short stories, but even if it was a collection of short stories, I would, since you're bringing it up, I don't know if I'd point it out otherwise, Patrick, but if I was like, walking around with Baudelaire and Manet in the 1860s and Baudelaire handed me this and asked for my thoughts, maybe I'd point out for a Creole lady and say like, hey, this is a good one for getting laid, but maybe it doesn't belong in this collection.
Sure. Hmm. I don't know. I would say that it works in the collection precisely because it offers a breath, like it gives us a chance to take a breath, which I think is kind of important. But that's my first reaction. But at the same time, like even with this, the book is, the collection is just dense with, imagery of disease and death and decay. And, so I don't actually know if we do take this as an attempt to offer thematic and compositional variety, I don't know that it's successful. So,
wait,
maybe you're right.
You brought up metal albums, and it's like the acoustic violin, like track that's inserted in the middle of a Gore Guts album.
Sure.
You know, maybe something like that. Or it's just, this is a poem that he had and he had to stick it somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I suspect that there's a certain amount of this is a poem he had and he had to stick it somewhere, right? I mean, I think like we should not underestimate how much pragmatic expediency determines artistic choices in any context, really. But I mean, I think that if you wanted to make an argument for the value of it in the larger collection, it so much of the kind of melodrama of tortured emotions, right? Like that means more, we assume, if it seems to be coming from a place of ruined idealism, right? You know, if this is someone who is in fact capable of genuine love, if this is someone who is in fact capable of deep affection and recognizing beauty, then it makes a lot of the kind of paroxysms of meanness and grossness more understandable, because I mean they're not just coming from a place of total pessimism and nastiness, right? They're coming partly from a place of being someone who's, we must assume, been heartbroken and disappointed and let down by a lot of things, and so having a little bit of a sense of, you know, the wounded romantic that presumably underlies a lot of the despair that we see.
Right.
You might see it as lending some depth, right? I mean, just from an aesthetic standpoint, maybe somebody who knew Baudelaire better than I do would disagree with this, maybe quite heartily, maybe I'm being totally unfair, but he just does the nasty stuff so much more, I don't want to say better, but like it feels much more characteristic, right? Like it, and you know, reading it, like there are lots of other tones and textures kind of coming in at the margins, but when he's, you know, things like spleen, where he's just, you know, persistently negative for not even totally clear reasons, other than some kind of what seems to be just a very basic sourness of character, the sourness is so much more, feels just so much more kind of distinct and convincing and unique to his poetic voice, that I think a lot of the other stuff kind of, it's easy to kind of gloss over a lot of the other things, right? I mean, and you know, from the standpoint of assembling a collection, I can see why you would want to have a broader range of tastes and textures, but it often feels like the other ones, even though, you know, they make, even though the kind of the other flavors and moods might make the collection much more interesting to analyze or much more thematically complex or, you know, much easier to write an essay about, ultimately they kind of feel less convincing when you encounter them. At least they did to me, and maybe that's unfair, you know, but I mean, like you, if I was understanding you correctly, you wrote this off a little bit as kind of like a generic, you know, a generic male gaze lust poem, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Like it seems like, I mean, I don't want to, like,
would anybody still be reading this? Like, would anybody still be reading this poem 100-odd years after it was published, if the person who wrote the poem had not also written a bunch of poems about, you
right.
know, mm-hmm. beautiful lady, I want to cut a hole in your side and fuck it.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it's a generic male gaze lust poem, I would say. Like, I think there is something cool going on with the variation on the Petrarchan sonnet. In that, I don't know if the Petrarchan sonnet, usually the Shakespearean sonnet has a final couplet with a turn at the end, but that's not something that usually goes in the Petrarchan sonnet. And this one does have a turn at the end, in the final line, because there's the final tercet, not a couplet, which I think is interesting. Also, the layout is closer to a Petrarchan, but it's a little different than an exact Petrarchan. So I don't know. I think there's some like cool formal stuff going on, but other than that, like content-wise, yes, I think it's a generic male gaze lust poem. And just to kind of back you up on what you were saying, Hans, like in contrast, we got these crazy poems that sound more authentic to Baudelaire. And so I wanted to read number 29, A Carcass, which is, it goes like this. Remember, my love, the object we saw that beautiful morning in June. By a bend in the path, a carcass reclined on a bed sown with pebbles and stones. Her legs were spread out like a lecherous whore sweating out poisonous fumes, who opened in slick, invitational style her stinking and festering womb. And then, like, it goes on and on, and, you know, the sun on this rottenness focused its rays to cook the cadaver till done. Like, it's really disgusting.
It is actually kind of funny how fucking gross this poem is.
Yeah, yeah. But the you of this poem is the Creole lady, his mistress. Like, it starts out, remember my love, the object we saw that beautiful morning in June. So it's like a poem to this woman that he's going out with, to his girlfriend. And yet, and then the final, one of the final stanzas is, and you in your turn will be rotten as this corpse, horrible, filthy, undone. O sun of my nature and star of my eyes, my passion, my angel in one. Yes, such will be you, O regent of grace, after the rites have been read, under the weeds, under the blossoming grass, as you molder with bones of the dead. And then, O my beauty, explain to the worms who cherish your body so fine that I am the keeper for corpses of love, of the form and the essence divine. See
oh my god, like,
this is a genius poem. Like, A Carcass is fucking great. It's a love poem to his girlfriend, and he's talking about how she's gonna be a decayed body. Oh my god. Okay.
And so he's implicating her in the memory too, right? Like, hey, remember that one time we were out walking around and there was this hot corpse with her legs spread like a whore? And her stinking womb was inviting us inside? Like, remember that? You had that experience, right?
like this is... So, like, compared to For a Creole Lady, I think this one is, like, it's much... It's... Like the as I was reading, the form was very sing-songy. You heard that?
Yeah.
So I don't know about that, but maybe the sing-songiness kind of like invites us to think of it as humorous. So maybe that's a hint that maybe the poems in this collection are leaning more ironic than sincere.
I'll say, reading it quietly to yourself, like basically reading it, not saying it out loud, like it's right. I didn't read this as humorous. I read it as just really, really kind of gross, and maybe I was a little bit tired, but like hearing you read it out loud,
yeah,
is so fucking funny. Like, it is, yeah, it's really funny.
I
you know, like, this feels like just like a, I don't know, like, I think about, you know, grad school and sitting around, you know, sitting around the living room with you guys, this feels like something that you just write for some buddies, right? And it just, and in a really, and then you just read it out loud and everyone just fucking dies. And like, it was definitely way funnier hearing you read it.
Oh man, this is great. So yeah. So maybe there is some evidence to suggest that these are ironic, funny poems. So let's see. So we're actually like on time. We're kind of well into it. So let's maybe think about some of the larger questions. Like there were a couple other questions I had about specific poems, but maybe we can think about, you know, I would call the narrator's worldview romantic pessimism, which is a term that's also been applied to Camus, but in a different way. Romantic or heroic pessimism. I think Camus has a much different worldview than Baudelaire does, even though they were both French. So I think we can call this, the narrator is a deeply pessimistic person, but the romantic part is like, it's told in a kind of romantic style. Is this dumb, or is there anything positive in this? What do we think about the overall pessimism of the work?
I mean, I think it can be cathartic, right? Like there are certainly times when I've been in the kind of mood that something like Spleen describes, right? Where everything just seems stupid and gross and nasty. And I mean, one of the kind of basic principles of one of the basic principles of pop culture for the last 50 years or so has been that, like, seeing your worst thoughts and feelings and ideas reflected back to you in art is in fact cathartic and heartening, rather than that it often purges those feelings rather than reinforces or deepens them.
Right.
And in that regard, this actually seems like an incredibly prescient and creative work, right? And I don't think it could achieve that effect without the kind of concentrated force of, you know, what you mentioned there as romantic pessimism, which I've kind of to some extent been calling absurd melodrama, right? I mean, I think that it's even though I'm kind of not a person who, at this point in my life, I don't think that I would find this material soothing or cathartic. I think that it reflects an artistic technique that's valuable in that regard, and it seems to have been awfully influential in the development of that, which I think is good, you know. And I think too that this is one of those poetry collections, or I mean, Baudelaire is one of those authors that is kind of more interesting sometimes to read people writing about than to actually read directly. You know, like I thought that the introduction actually, like we all, if I'm remembering right, we all read a PDF of the same edition of this collection. And the introduction I thought was quite an interesting read and sort of made me more positively inclined to the poetry than the poetry itself would have, right? And one thing that it talked about was the, and I guess credit is due, I guess I should give the author of the introduction here. The introduction to our edition. Who wrote this introduction? The introduction to the Oxford World Classics University Press edition of Flowers of Evil, which was is uncredited that I can find. We'll have to add that.
I've got the title page up. It's translated by James McGowan, who writes a translator's note, but also
introduction by Jonathan Kohler.
Yes.
Introduction by Jonathan Coler. So Coler's introduction makes the point that, you know, the part of what happens here is because there are, you know, feelings and sensibilities other than just the kind of one-dimensional vileness, right? That the unpredictable, self-contradictory subjectivity of the modern subject is kind of born here, right? That, like, the clash of the lack of a need to establish internal consistency is very daring in that regard. It reminds me a bit, I mean, we've kind of been tying this to pop culture pretty regularly, which I think makes sense, right? Because this has been directly and indirectly influential. It reminds me a bit of, like, you know, when I was in high school and I started listening to things, to hip hop, right? To things like DMX or Tupac Shakur or Eminem, it drove me nuts how self-contradictory that music is, right? How you have, like, one song that's all about, you know, very, very kind of callous graphic descriptions of violence or casual sex, and then another song about, you know, I love you, mama, please forgive me, God. And it was, and as a teenager, it was hard to kind of not go, well, make up your fucking mind, right? Like, how sure. how do you have this album with these, like, drastically different worldviews from one song to another? Like, either you've changed and moved beyond being, you know, this violent, callous, sexist person, or you haven't, right? Like, and of course, you know, like, with a certain amount of maturity, like, that contradiction is the whole point of those albums, right? That state of uncertainty and those conflicting impulses, the way that the album as a whole kind of captures those conflicting impulses, is the whole point of that art. Maybe not the whole point, but the most compelling thing about it. And, you know, the fact that Baudelaire was willing to let go of the need for kind of emotional and personal and ideological consistency is, to my limited historical understanding, one of the daring things about this collection. To some extent, it's kind of undone or kind of undermined by, as we've already mentioned, the fact that he's so much more original and compelling in one particular mode, right?
Right.
But, you know, it's still a pretty interesting innovation. Now, you know, I guess your question was, are there things in this worldview which are valuable? And I'm mainly pointing out things which are aesthetically creative rather than, like,
right,
you know. So the answer is maybe to some extent, like, valuable more as an aesthetic practice than an actual philosophical or emotional viewpoint.
Right.
But,
well, I suppose, you know, seeing, like you were talking about albums like Tupac, DMX, and whatnot, where you have these conflicting personality, not personalities, but conflicting worldviews, kind of described in different songs. And then we've got a similar thing going on here in Flowers of Evil. I think that as a worldview, like, it, allowing ourselves to be conflicted people and is good as a worldview, not just as an aesthetic practice. Like, obviously, as an aesthetic practice, I think that's super, super important to modern fiction, really, really anything, to any kind of character explanation. We've got to describe a round character who has various conflicts and tensions within their personality traits and their desires and whatnot. So that's definitely aesthetically important, but it also seems important as a worldview as well, in recognizing that people are multifaceted. So I know that's like a simplification or a reduction, but it seems useful.
Sure.
Okay. So, yeah, I think we have covered, we didn't get to everything, but we've covered a lot of this stuff that I feel like is important in kind of understanding the persona of the narrator and kind of what this collection is driving at. So I'm gonna say, Chris, what are we reading next?
I want to read The Passenger, Cormac McCarthy's newest.
No shit. I'm in the middle of reading it right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I was hoping that the follow-up Stella Maris would be out in time for us to read them both, but it looks like that's not coming out until December. I thought it was coming out. I only just learned that it's not coming out until December 6th, but, so
I could pick it later.
You could pick it later. I really had intended. I thought it was coming out like this week. So I kind of screwed that pooch.
I've read that from what I've read about them, it seems like they're kind of meant to be read in conjunction with each other. Like they kind of
complete
each other and make each other up a little bit. So
maybe I should pick a different work then. Because I did want to kind of pick them
what if Hans picks his this time and then next time you pick both.
Is Hans, do you have one, or is that just sort of passing the buck in a different way? Because I could pick another one. I just need to choose a different one.
I mean, I can always pick a book. I had a tentative choice that I was going to read over the next week or two to evaluate for the choice. I could just throw it out there, and if it sucks, it sucks.
Hey, I do that all the time.
I very rarely pick things that I haven't read, but I picked The Aikman when I'd only read one story from it. That panned out okay for Chris, at least.
Whatever you guys think.
Yeah,
it's
so
also
Stella
notable,
Maris
I think.
Is coming, Stella Maris is coming out the 6th. The 6th of December, so that would be the Tuesday after we next record. So if you want to pick now, then I can pick Passenger and Stella Maris together, and we can read those two together.
Yeah.
Notably, are we also kind of giving up on the practice of explicitly trying to link book A to book B as we move forward, like the kind of chain thing? It seems like
I think we are.
Well, it's totally fine with me.
The Passenger has like at least one, and Stella Maris has like does inquire into quantum theory and stuff. So from what I understand, so it's not really, Baudelaire, I have to admit, Patrick, I just wasn't really inclined to go further down that road.
I get it. This was taxing. Like there was good stuff in it, but it was definitely a hard read, I think.
Yeah. I'm not tying it explicitly to Baudelaire, but I am tying it back to a branch that we delved into a little bit, a couple months ago. But I don't think we have to keep doing that.
Yeah, that's fine with me. All right. Well, I had been planning to read and evaluate the possibility of choosing The Furrows by Namwali Sirpel. So I guess I'm just going to say fuck it and pick it.
All right, The Furrows. All right. Okay, listeners. Well, this has been our discussion of The Flowers of Evil by Charles Baudelaire. In places, extremely interesting and awe-inspiring work, and in other places, a little tough to take. So I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. We're going to discuss The Furrows by
Namwali Sirpel.
Next time.
I can put it in the chat.
So tune in for that. Peace out, everyone.